members do not work for either industry or the government. Congress expects to get the straight poop from IOM. However, by that time, Dr. Fauci had already figured out how to control the IOM with invisible strings. The Capitol Hill lawmakers never realized that Dr. Fauci's PIs dominated the IOM panel that assembled to investigate his wrongdoing. 6 of its 9 members were NIAID grant recipients, then conducting their own trials for Dr. Fauci, with annual grants ranging from $120,000 to $2 million. The IOM study on Dr. Fishbein's charges was predictably, therefore, yet another whitewash. The IOM panel strategically adopted an extremely narrow scope of investigation that did not include NIAID's outrageous misconduct in Uganda or Tennessee. On April 7, 2004, the IOM panel reported its finding that the HIV-NET-012 data should be considered valid. That same day, Dr. Fishbein received a letter of termination from Tremont. Dr. Fishbein sought and received an automatic postponement of his sacking as he argued his whistleblower case before the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Tremont's action, in the middle of a congressional investigation, was a naked gesture of defiance toward NIH's congressional overlords from both political parties. It signaled HHS's resolution to protect Dr. Fauci at any cost and to muzzle criticism by his principal detractor. Teflon Tony had come a long way since 1987, when his public blistering by Congress had left him remorseful and terrified for his future. By 2004, he had the protection of his boss, a powerful Republican president who, thanks to Dr. Fauci, was also implicated in the corrupt HIV-NET trials and who cared little for the distempers of a Democrat-controlled Congress. Frustrated and angry at Dr. Fauci's insubordination, Grassley and Baucus fired off a letter dated June 30th to NIH Director Elias A. Zerhouni, demanding an explanation for Dr. Fishbein's firing and accusing NIAID of retaliating against Dr. Fishbein to silence his corruption charges against NIAID. The letter noted that retaliation against an employee for reporting misconduct is unacceptable, illegal, and violates the Whistleblower Protection Act. Meanwhile, a secret internal NIH review of the Nevirapine trials was confirming Dr. Fishbein's worst accusations about Dr. Fauci and HIV-NET. On August 9, 2004, Dr. Ruth Kirchstein, senior advisor to Zerhouni, sent the NIH director the results of her investigation. Kirchstein warned that Dr. Fauci's efforts to fire Fishbein, at the very least, gave the appearance of reprisal. Kirchstein added that it is clear that Dr. Fauci's AIDS branch is a troubled organization and that Dr. Fishbein's complaint is clearly a sketch of a deeper issue. Zerhouni kept quiet about these damning results from the agency's internal investigations. Defying the Senate, he fired Dr. Fishbein on July 4, 2005. Following his dismissal, Dr. Fishbein brought his case before the Merit Systems Protection Board, asserting protection from any official retaliation under federal whistleblower laws. The MSPB reinstated Dr. Fishbein after determining his firing was wrongful retribution. It was clear, however, that Dr. Fishbein had no future at NIH. He negotiated a termination deal. The terms of Dr. Fishbein's settlement agreement with NIAID are secret, and the deal forbids him from discussing its particulars. Dr. Fishbein told me that despite his nominal victory, Dr. Fauci continued to punish him from afar with reverberations reaching far beyond NIAID. "I couldn't get a job in public health For 5 years, Dr. Fishbein says, of Dr. Fauci's vendetta. Everyone in science is terrified of crossing him. He's like a mafia kingpin. He controls everything and everyone in public health. Dr. Fishbein added, he spreads so much money around, and everyone knows he is vindictive. I had one friend tell me, I can't risk hiring you because I can't afford to anger Fauci. Says Dr. Fishbein, this was my first exposure to the cancel culture. He further reminisced, I left the private sector and took the NIH job because I wanted to do public service, but I was very naive. I believed the government could find solutions and that justice always prevailed. My experience at the Division of AIDS really opened my eyes about how the system really operated. The federal budget is a big trough to feed special interest groups. But if you become wise to it, open your mouth and get on the wrong side of someone really powerful, they are out for blood. The government lawyers up, and they have unlimited resources to burn you. Truth may not be on their side, but they can throw every obstacle in your way to getting a fair hearing of your grievance. And you can't get justice, because litigation will drain you to your last penny. The system isn't designed to help the aggrieved party. I couldn't coerce Fauci for a deposition. He was too busy doing interviews and accepting awards. There were never any consequences for the perpetrators. They continued merrily in their careers. I had to start all over again. If they are determined to ruin your life, they can do it. Farber is also disenchanted. They unleash such violence over your whole existence if you cross them. You never walk the same again. They make you feel like you are a dead person, totally devalued. They put a lot of money into these attack campaigns over my article. They went nuclear. Their crusade to discredit and destroy me had lasting impacts on my life. But you know what? I didn't get murdered. Joyce Hafford did. I think of her all the time. And the real losers in that battle, added Farber, were the millions of African women and babies forced to take nevirapine, a drug that does not prevent AIDS, but sickens and kills people who take it. In the end, Dr. Fauci succeeded in rigging corrupt clinical trials, concealing catastrophic cheating, and deftly manipulating the politics to bring his dangerous and inefficacious drug, nevirapine, to market. In March 2005, Dr. Valinder Turner, a surgeon at the Department of Health in Perth, Australia, pointed out in a letter to Nature, none of the available evidence for nevirapine comes from a trial in which it was tested against a placebo. Yet, as the study's senior author has said, a placebo is the only way a scientist can assess a drug's effectiveness with scientific certainty. Dr. Turner observed that the transmission rate that HIV NET012 reported for HIV, 13.1%, was above the background transmission rate. The HIV NET012 outcome is higher than the 12% transmission rate reported in a prospective study of 561 African women given no antiretroviral treatment. This, in effect, is the placebo group. If anything, then, Dr. Fauci's pet drug has aggravated rather than prevented transmission in all those African babies he was pretending to save. Farber argues that, under Dr. Fauci's leadership, the failure of researchers to properly control with a placebo group is perhaps the outstanding characteristic of AIDS research in general. The statistical gimmick of getting rid of the inert placebo control group would become a tool wielded by Dr. Fauci to gain approvals for hundreds of new drugs and vaccines, from AIDS to COVID. According to Farber, as it was, there was no placebo group, so HIV NET's results are a statistical trick, a shadow play, in which success is measured against another drug and not against an inert placebo, the gold standard of clinical trials. The single beneficial outcome of Dr. Fishbein's ordeal was that congressional and press questions about Dr. Fauci's personal financial stakes in the IL-2 drug forced Dr. Fauci to pledge to donate his royalties from the scheme to charity. HHS thereafter changed its royalty policies a little, limiting royalty payments to contract employees to $150,000 per year, per employee, per patent. In the 30 years since, no member of the media has ever asked Dr. Fauci how much money he made on IL-2 or to which charity, if any, he directed his donations. Nor has Dr. Fauci ever disclosed the extent of his personal stakes or the financial returns from his patents on other NIAID drugs or the royalty amounts he has rewarded to loyal cronies and underlings at NIAID for the thousands of other new drugs the agency has developed. Finally, during all of Dr. Fauci's tenure at NIH, Dr. Zeke Emanuel was director of the Department of Bioethics, DOB, the ethical oversight board for all of NIH. Emanuel's deputy was Tony Fauci's wife, Christine Grady. In 2012, Grady took over as director of DOB. That department oversees bioethics at clinical trials for all NIH sub-agencies, including responsibilities for overseeing ethical issues in clinical trials commissioned by her husband, like those for Nevirapine and Proleukin. Grady acknowledged in an interview with Vogue that she was aware of Tony Fauci's reputation as a very scary person upon their first meeting in 1983. Everyone was afraid of him, and when I first saw him, I thought, what are they talking about? He's young, he's handsome, and doesn't seem that scary. Dealing with Tony Fauci is like dealing with organized crime, says Dr. Fishbein. He's like the Godfather. He has connections everywhere. He's always got people that he's giving money to in powerful positions to make sure he gets his way, that he gets what he wants. These connections give him the ultimate power to fix everything, control every narrative, escape all consequence, and sweep all the dirt and all the bodies under the carpet, and to terrorize and destroy anyone who crosses him. Please go to the Children's Health Defense website for the acknowledgments, endnotes by chapter, updates to data, and new information that becomes available on any of the subject matter covered in this audiobook. Chapter 9, The White Man's Burden. Take up the white man's burden, the savage wars of peace. Fill full the mouth of famine, and bid the sickness cease. Rudyard Kipling, The White Man's Burden, 1897. In 1984, following Dr. Robert Gallo's notorious press conference, Dr. Fauci promised the world an AIDS vaccine forthwith. Delivering a functioning AIDS immunization would, of course, be the most persuasive debunking of the Duisbergians and other critics of the HIV-AIDS hypothesis. Finally, Dr. Fauci assured the global press, given the fact that we now have the virus in our hands, it is quite possible, in fact, it's inevitable that we will develop a vaccine for AIDS. Margaret Heckler told the media scrum, "We hope to have a vaccine ready for testing in about 2 years." Heckler was off the mark by a third of a century and counting. In the intervening decades, the federal government spent well over half of $1 trillion on AIDS. Dr. Fauci has dedicated much of that moolah to his quest for an elusive vaccine to immunize people against HIV. Dr. Fauci pumped our money into nearly 100 vaccine candidates, with none of these coming even close to the finish line. All these disappointments never darkened Dr. Fauci's buoyant optimism that he will soon collar that retreating horizon. For a decade, Oklahoma's U.S. Senator Tom Coburn, M.D., occupied front-row seats in congressional and Senate health committees during Dr. Fauci's annual gallivants to Capitol Hill. By 2010, Coburn had wearied at the NIAID director's bootless promises of the imminent delivery of his quixotic jab. When on May 18th, Dr. Fauci returned to the Senate hearing room to tout significant progress in HIV vaccine research, the normally taciturn Dr. Coburn finally exploded. He lambasted Dr. Fauci for deliberately deceiving lawmakers and accused his fellow physician of hoodwinking Congress into approving appropriations with no purpose beyond sustaining his bureaucracy. Most scientists involved in AIDS research believe that an HIV vaccine is further away than ever, he said. It had taken years of Dr. Fauci's ritualistic pilgrimages for Coburn to recognize with indignant clarity that attempted HIV vaccines are an ATM for NIH, whether they work or not. From an institutional standpoint, none of Dr. Fauci's failed experiments were, after all, failures. They each resulted in massive transfers of public lucre to Dr. Fauci's pharma partners and sustaining funding for NIAID's laboratories and PIs. The only true failure at NIAID would be a shrinking workforce. This verity remains utterly obscure to the dewy-eyed press, which faithfully applauds each of Dr. Fauci's Groundhog Day encores. In 2019, nearly a decade after Coburn's remonstrance, and only a few months before the COVID-19 pandemic, Dr. Fauci made a surprise announcement. He finally had a working HIV vaccine. While the inoculation had demonstrated a bare-bones 30% efficacy in human trials in Thailand, data from the Phase 3 trial in South Africa looked promising, and NIAID was getting teed up to test the vaccine on Americans. Dr. Fauci added some deflating caveats. While his new vaccine didn't prevent transmission of AIDS, the nimble technocrat jauntily predicted that intrepid souls who took the jab would find that when they did get AIDS, the symptoms would seem to be much reduced. So confident was Dr. Fauci of the media's slavish credulity that he assumed correctly that he'd never need to answer the many questions raised by this feverish gibberish. That entire odd proposition received zero critical press commentary. His success at slapping lipstick on this donkey and selling it to the world as a thoroughbred may have emboldened his ruse a year later of placing similar cosmetics on the COVID vaccines that likewise neither prevent disease nor preclude transmission. A parade of horribles. The 30-year decampment of journalistic scrutiny means that there is still no coherent public narrative chronicling Dr. Fauci's futile quest for his inevitable AIDS vaccine, much less accountability. Industry and government scientists have instead shrouded the scandalous saga in secrecy, subterfuge, and prevarication, obscuring a thousand calamities and a sea of tears deserving its own book. Every meager effort to research the debacle on Google, PubMed, news sites, and published clinical trial data yields only shocking new atrocities, a grim, repetitive parade of horribles, heartbreaking tragedies, entrenched institutional arrogance and racism, broken promises, vast expenditures of squandered treasure, and the recurring chicanery of Anthony Fauci, Bob Gallo, and Bill Gates. It's a darker version of Groundhog Day, devoid of humor, irony, wisdom, or redemption. It will be an easier read if I touch on only a few random lowlights of the painful saga. Gallo Redux. In 1991, as part of a settlement ending years of litigation, Bob Gallo finally admitted that he had stolen the HIV virus from Montagnier. He was hardly chastened. On April 14th, John Crutzen reported in the Chicago Tribune that one of Gallo's experiments with an HIV vaccine had killed 3 AIDS patients in Paris the previous year. NIH had launched the project before handing it off to Gallo and his trusty henchman, Daniel Zaghouri, who tested the concoction on volunteers in France and, predictably, an African country, this time Zaire. His cronies at the National Cancer Institute had granted Gallo's experiments expedited review approval. How expedited? Just 25 days. The patients died after Gallo's team inoculated them with an HIV vaccine derived from cowpox. NIH scientists formulated the preparation from vaccinia, a virus that causes cowpox in bovines, into which the government scientists genetically inserted a fragment of the HIV virus. Apparently, the cowpox remained infectious, and 3 of their 19 Paris volunteers immediately developed vaccinia, a frequently fatal necrosis, which caused acute lesions and an expanse of hardened, swollen, purplish-red skin around the victims' injection sites as the disease devoured their flesh. As is typical of AIDS vaccine research, the NIH scientists cached the atrocity. Neither Gallo nor Zaghouri reported the deaths. Instead, Gallo vaunted the trial as a great success in The Lancet's July 21, 1990 edition, audaciously claiming that there had been no deaths and no complications or discomfort among any of those to whom he administered the preparation. One of Dr. Gallo's casualties was a 42-year-old classic literature professor, regarded as a brilliant Egyptologist, who succumbed March 5, 1990, more than 4 months before Gallo's article appeared. A second volunteer, a 36-year-old Paris University librarian, died on July 6, weeks before Gallo published his article. Friends described Gallo's 2 victims as healthy and vibrant in the days and weeks immediately preceding their deaths. It was unimaginable, a co-worker said of the robust professor, that he could have died 6 weeks later. A longtime friend of Dr. Gallo's 3rd victim, who died on October 1, 1990, asked Zaghouri's principal assistant, Dr. Odile Picard, whether the experimental vaccine may have caused the destructive lesions that the coroner detected on the victim's brain during autopsy. Picard assured him the vaccines were not at fault, adding, "We don't know what this is." A month after this conversation, Picard delivered another paper, also signed by Gallo and Zaghouri, at an international AIDS meeting in Paris, the Colloque des Sans Gardes. Here again, Picard mentioned nothing about the 3 deaths, telling her colleagues that the vaccinia preparation had shown itself safe in patients. Perhaps she meant safe for those patients who survived. André Bouet, the distinguished French geneticist and secretary to France's National Committee on Medical Ethics, who approved the vaccine trials in 1987, complained that Gallo never informed his panel that any of the subjects had died. Officials of Assistance Publique, the municipal hospital system in Paris, grumbled that Gallo's team also neglected to tell them of the 3 fatalities. French officials only learned of the deaths from physicians who became suspicious at hospitals where Gallo's team had shipped their ailing recruits to die. NIH managers also protested that Gallo had not come clean about the deaths. One functionary called Gallo's omission very troubling. NIH records show that neither Gallo nor any of his NIH confederates informed the Office of Protection from Research Risks about the body count. Federal law requires that OPRR approve human experimentation and that researchers report adverse events, including, of course, the most adverse event. In February, citing multiple violations of federal regulations by Gallo and his team on both sides of the Atlantic, the OPRR abruptly halted the experiment. Channeling his mentor's hallmark chutzpah, Zaghouri after submitting the Chipper Lancet article, applied for a patent on the deadly vaccine technology called Methods of Inducing Immune Responses to the AIDS Virus, with Zaghari listing himself as an inventor in the application. Once again,